I regain control, but something feels off-kilter. At first, I hear a hiss, like there's a water snake trapped in the mobile. Then, from the battered side that took the blow, a spray of water shoots through. I'm struck in the jugular by so much pressure, I don't know how it doesn't pierce skin. I need to end this. I need to end this now. And I can think of a perfectly good, possibly, suicidal way. If Katana wants me to smash myself into a brick wall, well, that's exactly what I'll do. Chapter 39. 5:15 p.m., Sunday. I swallow so loud I can hear it in my ears. This better work. And by work, I mean in 1 hour I get to hear Callum ream me out for pancaking his Omni. That right there? Best case scenario. 'Cause if I'm listening to him yell at me, it means I'm alive. I can't believe I'm doing this. Of all my plans, this one is by far the craziest. I veer left, into the open channel. Turning off the belly props, I bring the mobile down a few feet, though we're both still too close to the surface for my comfort. Closer to the canal's floor means farther from Mad Ave and all those people. At worst, the explosion will send a few people in for a dip. Better than burning them to death. There's a building back behind me that should do the trick. Of course, ain't no need to be picky when it comes to blowing myself up. I jiggle at the wheel, veering the sub left and right, making it look like I've lost control. Chief, Governor Voss, and Katana all need to think what happens next is an accident. If she's right, and the governor is keeping an eye out, my being dead can only help what Callum and I are trying to pull off. Governor Voss will never expect anything from a dead girl. I gun the engine. Katana follows me out 100 feet or so. Then I shift 180 degrees, turning back the way I came, aiming to cross beneath Mad Ave at a perpendicular. Autopilot, in 15 seconds, shift speed to 130 miles per hour, I say to the voice nav. Then shift angle to 45 degrees downward. I just autogun her right away, but I'll need those 10 seconds to get into the airlock without the Omni sliding me around. And a 45-degree angle should be wide enough so that Callum's Omni will hit the building. I'm no Benny, though. I never liked playing pool. I'll need to jump ship before she hits. I could do it now. Checking the periscope again, I see Katana. Not now. Too soon. She'll spot me for sure. I look around the Omni, sit back down. All of a sudden, it's no longer an Omni. The phrase buried alive comes to mind. Though these days we just weight the bodies into the canal, or burn them when we can. Or, if they were important enough, we'll send them down the strait on a boat. We don't put our dead in coffins, but that's exactly what this Omni's starting to look like. A coffin. It closes itself around me, and my insides start to shake. The soles of my hessians drum against the floor, and to kill the nerves in my hands, I squash them both under my butt. I've been nervous before, but this is different. The sack, all that water, it's sitting right there. Too much. Too much responsibility. Looking at it, again, I wonder if every life is equal, if every life carries the same weight, has the same value. Take that sack. What's in there can save a few hundred lives. Then take me, one person. If every life is equal, then that sack is more important than me, if only 'cause it holds more lives. But what if everyone in that sack is evil? Murderers. And I, not knowing, give my life to save them. What then? Are we all still equal? It's the most confusing word problem in the world, where every number changes depending on what you do or don't do. My head spins. Get it together, I moan to the dashboard, because I have to stop the panic before it disables every ounce of courage I ever thought I had. Brack, I curse to myself. You can't die. It's just Avon. Forget the others. It's just Avon. I have to make it, if not for the other numbers. For her. And like someone's opened a window, That does it. I can put the math problem aside. I can breathe again. Never liked numbers anyway. Countdown to autopilot, please, I ask, steeling myself for the next 10 seconds. 10 seconds? She says it so kindly, ladylike, classy. Makes me think I'm headed for a ball, not a brick wall. Turning off the headlight and the belly lamp sends the mobile pitch dark. Gotta get a move on. I walk back into the airlock hatch, still dripping, and wait. Crouched in a ball, I'm the same size as the red rubber sack swung over my side. I'm the same damn size, except I'm just one life. Numbers pop back into my head again. That thing has to count for hundreds. Thousands, maybe. Just one. 7 seconds. Just one. 6 seconds. Can't jump now. Have to wait until the sub shifts to the new speed. That'll take 3 seconds at least. 5 seconds. Then, when I feel the sub shift down, I'll know I'm out of Katana's line of sight. She'll be above me. That's when I'll hit the red button and land myself back in the brack. The seconds drag on, each longer than the last. I clutch the sack by my side, hugging my knees in that curled-up position. I imagine the one life in there that matters. Avon. I picture her next to me. She's telling me I'm doing the right thing, that she doesn't blame me for choosing Callum. That thought, though, it kills me. My eyes sting, and I blink away a tear that starts on a path over the bridge of my nose. There's hardly enough room to wipe it away. I inhale and exhale. I realize my nails are digging into the sack. Fear freezes me up. I loosen my grip and breathe out all the air in my lungs, prepping for the dive and the air hunger. 3 seconds. I push the button. Swim out, then down. Under Katana's sub, behind her, up. Get myself dockside, onto Mad Ave. 2 seconds. Then, back to Callum. Katana will think I'm dead. Then she'll tell Derek, who'll tell Terrence, and the chain of gossip in the ward will spread faster than the blight. Everyone will know. 0. Shifting to speed 130 miles per hour. Shifting to angle 45 degrees. The Omni bucks and sways. The damage has made scrap of it. Not just yet, I think. Let's go out with a bang. I know it's only metal. It can't think. But this is all I can do. We jerk from side to side and I feel the nose dip, angling itself toward the building. It's pulling the speed, all its belts and cogs on the inside straining against the added weight. A low layer of water already slicking the floor. Faster. It's getting faster. One more jolt, and it'll really be moving. Propulsion pushes me back. I claw the floor with my fingertips. Now is no time to screw up. I push the red button. Water rushes in, a shock of cold everywhere. Have to wait until the airlock is mostly full before I swim out, otherwise the water will just push me back in. Soon I'm submerged. One last chug of air, mouth pressed against the roof. I realize the last thing on earth my mouth might ever touch is the roof of Callum's Omni. I push myself out of the doomed mobile, sack hauled over my shoulders. Seconds later, orange headlights shine directly overhead as Katana's Omni sends a rush of water my way. I'm thrown into a somersault. The weight of the sack slows me some and disorients me more. I try to keep my lips tight together, imagining that they've been sewn shut, but they open, and my own air bubbles drift away from me. At first, I hate myself for being weak, for letting them go. But then I realize, they are my compasses. When the somersaults stop, down is up is down. These bubbles are the only thing that remind me which way ain't lying. I follow them, not sure where I am under Mad Ave. Don't care. Again, I find myself frog stroking for the surface with my body fighting 1,000 icy jackknives, each one telling me to stop moving. To stop moving means to stop fighting, but I'm so far away. And the sack is so heavy, and my boots, My boots are also dragging me down. Almost 50 feet to surface, and it's taking too long. Callum's Omni will hit any second now, and if I'm in the water when it does, that's it. Underwater explosions are even more dangerous than ones on land. The blast from the pressure wave would turn me into a ball of ruptured junk. I'm fuzzy on the science, but it's bad. Of course, that's for, like, a hand grenade. Who knows what happens when a mobile explodes? I drag my toes against my heels, lifting the soles of my feet out of my boots. One drifts off, then the other, and I can't even afford to spare a glance at my beloved Hessians as I sink to the floor. Nor will I tell myself that they're just shoes. They're not. They were like a second pair of feet. The upward haul goes slightly faster now, with the boots gone. I've still got the weight on my back to deal with. Only 20 feet or so away. Ears crackle as I close the distance. And then my temples flare under the pressure. That's when I feel the first wave. It pushes me to the side, takes the rest of the air from my lungs. I open my mouth. I don't want to. I know not to. But I swallow the greenish-tinged water by the mouthful. I'm only 4 feet. 3 feet. Fingertips break the surface. They hit hard wood. My head comes up too quickly. Boardwalk, I remind myself, but the need to breathe trumps all. A thwump to my cranium, and outer space has direct mailed me every one of its stars. Planets, too, free of charge. I see black. Black and more black. I won't go under again, though, and I grip the planks, keeping afloat. After a few retching gasps, I can actually begin to start breathing again instead of just hacking up water. I swim under the boardwalk till I reach the dockside. Wet and bedraggled, I haul myself over the edge. First things first, I reach around my back, feeling for the rubber pack. It's there. Setting it down, I look for any holes in the rubber. Seeing none, I decide a little jig is in order. In honor of the sack, and me. People start circling around the edge of the walk, about 30 feet off, where a chunk of the wooden planks has gone missing. Someone calls the DI. A huge collision, under Mad Ave. Yes, I hear them say. Any other day of the week, the Blues wouldn't care less about that sort of thing. They'd ignore the call till the monthly arrests. Then, maybe they'd send over divers. Today, though, they'll be on it. And they'll find my shoes. Soon enough, I'll be off their radar for good. My cuffcom beeps its reminder, and I glance down. Quad 56, B, sick house on the straight, apartment penthouse 305. Callum's new address. I hardly believe it. And not because it's all the way west, practically in the DI's backyard. Or because he's chosen to hide out in a sick house. Both those are either brilliant moves or sheer idiocy. But they're not why I'm standing still. That sick house, the only one in Hell's Kitchen, is the last place on Earth I want to go back to. That's where I found Avon after my DI training was up. Seeing her alone, looked after by strangers who could do nothing for her because she had no money for daggers. I still feel the guilt of leaving her behind 3 years later, though I was snatched up, no choice in the matter. She's alone right now. She could die like that. My chest holds in a boulder, one that keeps getting pushed up and downhill. And the only thing that seems to make it better is being near her. Yet here I am. I should be with her. I want to be with her. But I'm so close. So close to getting her a cure. Starting the shoeless trek back to Hell's Kitchen. A cure in reach. I wonder why my guilt feels no different today than it did the day I found her. Like nothing's changed. Maybe nothing has changed. Instead of being with her, I'm always off someplace else. Off far, far away. Thinking that I'm big enough and strong enough to fight her death for her. And win. Part 3. Chapter 40. 6 p.m., Sunday. The The suspension bridge sways under my feet, heavy with me and the sack, and other things like life and love that you simply can't touch with your hands. Overhead, quiet and perfect, like nothing could ever go wrong in the world, I see the stars, out in full force. If Calum and I can pull tonight off, my brain don't even know how to think that kind of thought. It can't imagine it. The borders will open. I'll be able to see the West Isle for the first time. But would I even want to? A city with people who push for genocide? Maybe, when you're not fighting to survive, you can afford to think about wiping others off the map. Either way, it's not important. Tonight isn't about getting tourist visas so we can take vacations to the Isle. I'm here. I see the roof of the Hell's Kitchen sick house only feet away, but I stop moving, stop crossing the bridge. Below, the wooden planks creak, and ahead of me, the strait splashes between us and the Isle. The ward isn't silent tonight, though. Not too far off, I hear the high-pitched whistle of a firecracker, then its thunderous finish, like it is its own exclamation point announcing itself to the sky, telling the world to get ready for what comes next. Tonight is about Avon, and the girl in the contagious ward, and everyone else afraid to go outside. It's about putting us back on the map, as people, and as a city. We're not hosts. I let go of my fist, tight around the suspension rope, and jump onto the rooftop. Opening the door out of the stairwell into the top floor hallway, I nearly gag. Have to hold my nose as I walk. The smell. It's worse than the dying stink of the hospital. Rank viscera. Old, decaying flesh. Blood loss, coppery, and acrid. This high up, and they usually just weight the bodies before tossing them into the canal below. But sometimes, the flesh is dying, and the body's still alive. The smell is the same. I can taste it all in the air, passing room after room. My stomach twists, and though this isn't the floor I found Avon on, it may as well be. All the doors look the same, and I can almost see myself pushing them open, frantic, yelling for anyone who might have seen the girl with the near-white hair. I come up on apartment 305, my footsteps quiet and even. Candlelight flickers under the door, and I don't even have to knock. It opens, and there's Calum. He pulls me in, wraps me up in a hug. Seeing the sack, his face is a mixture of wonder and even more wonder. "You made it," he says, and kneels beside it. "Is this really it?" Disbelieving, he lifts it up by the straps to feel its weight. "To the brim," I say softly, and I pat the rubber, a little bit proud. Then I look at him, really look at him, give him the once-over, 2-3 times. "You're whole," I say, wide-eyed, and he manages a weak laugh, nodding. Even with the cure, everything is tense. There's too much dying. As he carries a sack to a corner of the room, a huge room, I see all the big furniture still here from after the washout, everything else, though, picked clean. "That I am," he answers, lowering the sack onto a bulky wooden table. Careful not to spill, he pours the water into a glass basin, shaking his head as he watches. He murmurs, "Only you," then glances at me with that strange, odd look again. I avoid his eyes. Each time that happens, I find myself going more and more red in the cheeks, like I'm too unusual. As he pours, the tiny green mushrooms fall out too. "What's this?" he murmurs, leaning in to get a closer look. Then he answers his own question. "A bioluminescent fungus." I don't know much about that first word, but I nod anyway. He's talking about the aliens, all right. "It's the plant you were talking about, right? It's how the water got those phyto things," I ask, but he don't answer. He's totally absorbed, filling an eyedropper with the spring water. "Amazing," he murmurs. Through the tube, I see now that the water is darker than I thought, a brownish-reddish color, flecked with neon. When he swirls it around, a glow-in-the-dark galaxy whirlpools in his very hand. He droppers it onto a glass slide, then adds a dye or something. He lays that under his scope's lens. For a moment, I'm surprised. I'm thinking the scope got lucky, survived the ransacking of the first lab. But then, I see Callum hold a super-duper bright flashlight over it. Katana's handiwork must have included bulb smashing. "Shine it here, please," he asks. I take it from him, trying to beam the light where he wants while he looks through the lens. After a few moments of him lifting his eye, moving the slide, adjusting the focus, and repeating the process about a half dozen times, Callum stands. In a whisper, eyes glazed like he's way too happy. I have no words. The fungus, it grows underwater, and the hot spring seeps out its nutrients, kind of like a tea. You know, I've heard of something like this before. He pauses, recalling as he looks up. There's a place called Siberia where a tree-growing mushroom exists, one with similarly beneficial properties, antiviral, antitumor, antibacterial, etc. Locals make tea out of it. Still, this one blows it away. Far more potent. Take a look. He nudges me in front of the scope. Peering down, I see a half dozen other patterns similar to the desert dunes and the bubbles. One looks like a fence, all X's and diamonds. Another ripples like the Hudson on a windy day. The antivirals, along with all the other necessary chemical compounds, are there. We can cure the blight with this, Callum tells me, tapping the table. When I look up, he adds, along with your blood, that is. I laugh, nervous. Again? I say, gesturing to myself. Remember, Callum, limited quantities only. He chuckles and walks over to me, syringe in hand, motions for me to roll up my sleeve. Don't worry, I won't need much. I step back. I don't believe him for a minute. We're talking enough for at least 800 people. Why? I thought with the mushrooms we'd have enough antivirals. We do. But like I said before, your blood does something to jumpstart the recipient's immune system. With it, we only need to administer one dose. Follow-up doses would be necessary otherwise, and we just don't have enough time, or water to do that. I nod. Without another thought, we've come too far to get tripped up over a little blood donation. I extend my arm, exposing my inner elbow. The tip of the needle pierces flesh. I watch my blood go away. And away. And away. Okay, mister, I grumble after even more time passes. Leave some for the girl in the body, will ya? Callum laughs, but doesn't move. Only when he feels he's taken enough does he step back. Then he looks at the desk. On it, three glass bowls, all different sizes. The first, and smallest, thank goodness, holds my blood. In the second, are alien mushrooms. The spring water is in the third bowl, swirly and neon. Biting his lower lip in a smile, Callum double punches the air. I'm full grinning too. We're going to do it, he says. We stand there, our eyes first caught on the bowls, then on each other, because hope has the perfect face. We need a plan to get it to everyone. And Avon, I say softly. Afraid of sounding too selfish. Even with all the others, I want to get her the cure first. Yes, we do, and we will. But first, I need to figure out what it is, he tells me. There's still so much we don't know. True, I say. I'm about to say more, but I stop, cross my arms. As soon as his name entered my head, the writhing came back, the anger. All of a sudden, it's like I'm holding that album again, filled with Derek and Katana's joy, centuries of lovey-dovey, gooey-eyed crap. Derek, who kissed me back, who would drink the water for himself and let me watch my sister die. The Tetai, Callum, they're not just guardians of the spring. They've been the spring's guardians, all along. Centuries. I saw pictures. Actual old-school flash photography. Callum eyes me, but but not with disbelief. Then he laughs, brows sky high, and scratches his head. I'd suspected that was possible, to be perfectly honest, but without seeing it in the water, I couldn't even attend to the possibility. He points back at the scope. I still can't see how, actually. We know that, for someone who's sick, the water has restorative properties if administered in multiple doses over time. But immortality? That's a whole different ballgame, I'm afraid. I walk back over to the scope to have another look. What if, I start, and peer down into the lens. Just in this tiny microcosm of a swab, there are dozens more pattern-like phyto-thingies than there were before, ones that look like hologram images of grassy fields, or rainbow feathers, or cords and cords of twisty rope. Maybe there's a new nutrient in here that does it. Or maybe if you're not sick, drinking it regularly stops you from getting older. The governor did say something about the results being miraculous when a healthy person drinks it every day. Callum's hand is firm on my shoulder as he says, You're kidding, right? You never mentioned that. I don't know, I answer, standing up and turning to face him. He said a lot of stuff. It was hard to keep track. I'd also just found out Derek is part of a secret guild responsible for hiding a cure that could save my dying sister. So there's that. I was kind of distracted. No need to mention that bit, though. I'm going to have to run tests. Many, many tests. So we don't accidentally hand out doses of immortality. Callum has started to look a little dazed. After you've figured out the cure part, I remind the absent-minded professor and him. Naturally. He casts me a glance like he didn't need the reminder. And I still don't understand how the spring would protect against the poison. Your bookie didn't happen to mention that, did he? I shake my head. Nope, just said it would. Callum grumbles, scratching his ear. I admit that there's still quite a bit we don't know about the water. I don't like it, but we're going to have to take it on faith that he knows what he's talking about. And considering he's been around the stuff for more than 500 years, I think it's safe to assume he does. Together, we turn to face the West Isle skyline, still visible through the dirtied, cracked window. Callum watches it like he's waiting for something to happen at any moment, which, if we wait long enough, it will. Then, the last order of business. Distribution, he says, leaning up against the bare white window frame. I've been thinking about how best to get Avon the new serum once it's made. I figure you'll have some tricks up your sleeve as far as the rest of the ward goes. Callum says it to me so naturally, like, of course I do. Like it's not a plan to prevent the government-sanctioned extermination of hundreds. I almost laugh out loud, but then I realize it's kind of a compliment. Callum trusts me. He barely knows me, and he thinks I can do this. I kind of like it. You first, I say nonetheless, looking over at him. Just because he thinks I have tricks don't mean I actually have them. At least not yet, I don't. Callum flips closed his cuffcom, and the Ward Hope Hospital schematics he's projected onto the wall disappear. The wall goes back to blank, with its peeling paint and cobwebbed corners. You really think that'll work? Will you have time to make two separate batches? I ask. What if the night guard catches me? Tampering with the water supply is probably one of the biggest crimes around. I know from experience. It's how I ended up in the DI jail. Don't worry, he insists. I already know how to make the water stronger. I can make enough for just the hospital within the next few hours, which is all the time we have if you're going to put it in the water system before the final night rations go out at 10. It's making the serum for the hundreds of others that will take time. The hardest part for you, Ren, will be getting in. I'd give you my ID badge, but it's too risky, he insists. The receptionist will have seen your image from the wanted broadcasts. You can't just walk in through the front door. I'll figure it out, I say, confident. I've totally got tricks up my sleeve when it comes to sneaking into and out of places. All right, Callum eyes me before sitting down in front of his scope. Your turn, he says, and glances at his comm for the time. I do the same, and have to remind myself to breathe. My stomach goes all knotty. Time just keeps passing, faster by the second. I've got no plan, and I've got to make it to Ward Hope by 10. All right. I repeat, slowly, hoping that an idea magically appears in my brain. Distribution. Come on. Come on, think. Of course, it's impossible to think when you're telling yourself to think, because all you're doing is saying that one word over and over, not actually thinking. Well, we've got to find a way to get enough vials of the cure onto every sick house rooftop in the ward. All before... My voice trails away. I sink into the thinking part. There are sick houses all over the U. We can't just walk around handing out some magic cure to everyone. That would take forever. Not to mention that people might be suspicious of taking some strange medicine they've never heard of. I scoff to myself. No one gets suspicious when they hear it from officials. They have to think it's their cure, I say aloud. Callum looks up, nods, waits for the rest. I go on. We can't swap one for another. Whatever poison they're giving out will be down people's throats as soon as it's on the roof. Everyone's gonna be waiting in their stairwells at least an hour beforehand, guaranteed. So we gotta get to them before the squadrons come through. Late enough that everyone still thinks our cure is coming from the government, but early enough that we are not around when the actual aeromobiles arrive. That's less than 6 hours away, he says, and it's going to take me half that long to make the cure. How do you propose we do it? Rooftop distribution. Countdown clock. Quick getaway. Uh-oh. What if? I start, excited, but then my fingers start fidgeting. I press what's left of my nails into my palms and begin pacing the length of the room. I've got an idea, all right, but no way is Callum gonna like it. Spit it out. We need the other dragsters. I let the idea hang in the air and wait for him to grab it, or swat it, and I think I see a swat coming. Callum's mouth takes the shape of, oh, hell no, so I cut him off before he can object. It's the best way. They're fast, and once they learn the truth, they'll want this plan to work as much as we do. Shaking his head. No, absolutely no. I just don't think it's safe, Ren, on so many levels. One, you'll be on the U, an entirely residential area, piloting those death traps, which, let's face it, he says, waving his hands around. And I know I'm not going to like what comes next, are really no more than scrap metal excuses for mobiles. Say what? I shoot him a glare made of so much evil. I think I actually see him step back, afraid, raise his hands and surrender. I'm sorry, he says. Perhaps that was uncalled for, but they're dangerous, and dragsters are notorious adrenaline junkies, yourself included. Not to mention how many people we'd be trusting with incredibly sensitive information. Callum, this was never gonna stay a small operation, not with so many sick. And, though I know it's not the same on the aisle, those of us who live here in the ward, well, we all know someone who's sick. Someone we love is always dying. That's just the way it goes. Curing the blight is probably the only thing that we'd ever be on the same side for. I can only hope that it's true. The ward's also got a survival of the fittest mentality that could get in the way. Answer honestly. Can you depend on them? I don't know. Would Kent ever be on my side for anything? Even this? He owes me. I think so, I say. I saved his butt today. And I don't have an idea that's better than this one. I flip open my comm, punch in Tear's number, then type my message. Dragster meeting. ASAP. Derby's 2. Bone Vault. Bring Benny. R.R. Even though this is an unregistered cuff comm, I use my racing initials, short for Red Rider. You sure they'll show? Callum asks, watching over my shoulder as I flip the comm shut. Not in the least, I think to myself. Especially not if they know that I'm the one calling the meeting. I open the cuff comm again and send him another message. Keep me dead, will ya? Terrence will know what I mean. Now they'll show, I say, nodding. Hoping. Chapter 41. 7:30 p.m., Sunday. The Bone Vault is a dismal place. No one ever comes here, and I don't blame them. Light would help, though. I glance around the space, then up at the chandelier. It's pieced together out of decades-old clavicles and smooth gray skulls that look like they died laughing. I decide against touching the thing and curse the insane architect whose idea it was to decorate a house of the dead with the actual dead. Even after the washout floated new and old bodies to the surface, but left us with no more land to put them. Really? This was someone's brilliant solution? Joke's on me, though, I suppose. When the blight hit, the ward had a place, ready and waiting to stash our bones. Reluctant, I reach for the skull to my right and pluck a candle from one of its eye sockets. When I strike a match from the pack in the jaw, an orange glow turns the vault into a bona fide nightmare. Now I can see too much. I wish I'd left the candle alone. All across the ceiling hang bony odds and ends, worn molars, sharp white knuckles, strung up side by side. Without warning, the same way you imagine your own death, a mobile crashing, a racer knifing you in the gut, I imagine every one of these bones belonging to Avon. Each knuckle grows muscles and skin and fingernails, becomes a hand, her hand, and it reaches out from the ceiling for me. I'm socked into nausea, ready to vomit. I double over the stone bench, head between my legs, and heave. Sliding off the bench, I huddle close to my knees on the dusty floor. I use my palms as blinders to block out the bones. I can't look at them. Clutching my gut, I wait for the sick feeling to pass. A slight wind sets the candle flickering. Shadows grow and shift. Some rustling sound kills the dead quiet, but I see nothing. In here, I'm swallowed whole. It's not just Avon anymore. This place is a monster. I've landed myself in its belly. Keeping me company is every body it's ever eaten, every body it will ever eat. Imagining the overflow of bones come tomorrow morning, that plants my feet. I'm standing on the barbed wire of guilt. I want to run, find Avon, but it'll just follow me. It fences in every choice. You in there, Ren? I think I hear Tare call. I peek my head out the window to check, and I see him standing there, face pressed against the glass. I inhale and slide down to the floor again with relief, watching my imaginary beasts scatter. Now all I'm left with are the real ones. I am, I call back, hearing his footsteps as he enters the vault. He finds me hunched on the floor, like I'm hiding from something. Quickly, I stand up, brush off the floor's grime. He folds me into a great big bear hug. Tare, I say, my voice muffled, nose pressed into his armpit. You're alive, he sings, holding on a few seconds longer before backing away. When I'm able to breathe again, I calmed you, didn't I? He starts laughing. It bubbles and bubbles and doesn't stop until he has to slow down for air. The rumors were insane, Ren. You scared the hell out of everyone. I found out from Derek. Tare breathes out, solemn all of a sudden. He was pretty messed up about it, actually. Which kind of surprised me, you know? Seeing my face, raised eyebrows and pursed lips, he waves his hand. Adds, not that he shouldn't have been upset, but I mean, he was just your bookie. Then Tare pauses, looks down at me. In the dark of the vault, with just candlelight to see by, the whites of his eyes are glowing. I can only guess at what's coming next. You guys didn't have a thing, did you? Like hell we didn't. Thank goodness. I shake my head, about to open my mouth, when Tare and I hear the sounds of feet shuffling and the tail end of a conversation. Divers found her boots and everything, even left a calling card. Can't tell who's talking. They're too far away. But they're definitely talking about me. I wrinkle my nose, mouth the words, calling card? At Tare, who points to my bare feet. A photo inside your boots? He mouths back. Then I remember, the picture I took from Callum's place. I'd stuck it in my poor Hessian and forgotten about it. Bet I was walking on that photo all day and didn't notice. Someone saved my boots, though, right? I ask, raising my voice. Tare rolls his eyes, pulls me into his arms again, and actually gives me a noogie. In a whisper, "They're boots, dummy. I'll buy you a new pair." "What you think this is about, anyway?" the voice asks, now just outside the window. It's Jones, definitely. Antsy, worried, nerves of glass. Throwing me a sideways glance, Tear mouths the same question, but I don't answer. No time.
"Dare say we'll find out soon enough."
That'd be Kent. I'd know that breezy sleaze of his voice any day. Just hearing it, and the hairs on my neck bristle. Craning my neck around the alcove, I watch as they enter the vault and exchange easy arm shakes with Terrence. He's not a girl. They don't hate him. A few more steps bring Kent into the main sanctuary. He sees me, and his face twists in disgust. Still? Has he forgotten already? I could have let that Omni plow into the canal, left him stuck there in the pit.
"What is she doing here?"
he snarls as he presses the black derby farther down his forehead, nudging a stray dark hair behind his ear. He looks to Tear, vexed. A dozen slurs are batting against the roof of my mouth, wanting out. I swallow every last one of them. I breathe deep. "Boys," I say, walking into the sanctuary with my gaze to the floor, my hands at my sides. Any other day, I'd come out fighting. Today, the first round is theirs. I won't fight them with my eyes. I won't store a fist in my pocket for later. I open my mouth, about to begin, then realize someone's missing. I look at Terrence. "Where's Benny?" I ask. He's going to be the hardest to see. I don't like anyone worrying about me. Him, most of all.
"Said he'd show later. I'm sure if he knew you weren't dead, he'd be here right now."
"But you are dead," Kent interrupts. "There is a party and everything." A dark smile worms across his lips. My fingers twitch, fighting to take position, but I keep him pressed down. Ignoring him, I go on. "Thank you all for coming. I've asked you to meet me here tonight, because what will happen over the next 3 hours affects each of us," I begin. The three pass unsure looks like hot potatoes. "Tonight, at 12:30, Governor Voss plans to eradicate the problem of the blight, only it won't be happening how we think." I pause to make sure I have everyone's attention. I do. "The announcement you heard was a lie." Tear is the first to speak.
"You're saying they don't have a way to cure the blight?"
From his tone, he doesn't disbelieve. He doesn't believe, though, either. "Oh, they'll get rid of the blight, all right. But it's not how you think. The cure won't just destroy the virus. It destroys carriers, too." I watch their faces, wait for my meaning to sink in. His plan is extermination. The vault absorbs each and every word into its bones. Maybe they remember life. There are no echoes of what I've spoken, only speechless digestion. I'm met with faces serious and grim, eyes downcast as they consider. Of course, since Tear was the first to give me the benefit of the doubt, it should come as no surprise that Kent is the first to laugh.
"Insane,"
he scoffs. It breaks their thoughts, turning to me.
"How do you even know this?"
He looks at Jones, then Tear. They hear his doubt, and now they're raising their brows, suddenly on the fence.
"You guys believe her?"
But no one knows how to answer, because no one else has heard the West Isle news. No one ever hears West Isle news. And I bet it goes both ways. Sure, they can pick up the signal, but what news of ours would they care enough to listen to? "Look," I tell everyone, taking off my cuff comm. I flip it open, sliding my finger across the screen, bring up the West Isle newspaper article Callum showed me. Then I project the headline onto the wall. "The Ward. A case for democide." I let them read the first few sentences of the column, and inhale, preparing to tell them the rest of the truth, how I know. I'd rather not, of course. But if they were to find out after the plan was already in motion, it could upset everything. And I know about this because... Brack, here goes. Can't believe I'm telling them. I hold my breath as I look at Tear. The others already hate me. But Tear? This is going to cut him up the worst. Because I used to work for the DI. Freshwater scouting, that's all. Someone cuts me off, but it's not Kent.
You've been working for the Blues?
Tear asks, and I read hurt on his face in 100 ways. He feels betrayed. I'm sorry, I start to say, but Terrence raises his hand to stop me.
I don't want to hear it. Not now.
He refuses to look at me.
Later.
I can't lose Tear. My chest starts to shake like I've got wings in there, beating away at the air, pushing me to run to him. They want me to make it better, and that's all I want to do. But he's right. Not now. Kent scoffs.
You expect that we'll believe you after you tell us that?
Yeah, I do. 'Cause I just love pissing off the people I work for no reason at all. Brilliant plan of mine. I spit back at him, probably harsher than I should. But I'm shaken by the thought of losing Tear, too, after realizing who Derek really is. And now, if I fail Avon, I can actually feel the threads of myself spinning out into nothing. The vault is silent. When Jones opens his mouth, we look at him, stunned. Kent, most of all. His sandy hair flops in his face, and he pushes it out of the way. Softly, he says,
Why'd you bring us here?
He's not asking meanly, but with curiosity. Keep it together. I inhale, and grip onto the new air with my lungs. Focus. Somehow, this next piece is harder to say, even though I've seen the serum in action. I lift my eyes, finally, to meet theirs head on. I want them to know the truth of what I'm saying. A cure does exist. I leave out the Fountain of Youth bit. Something tells me it makes the story a little less believable. And now that I've dropped the conversational, opposite equivalent of the atom bomb, I wait. Jones makes no movement. He's thoughtful. Kent laughs through a breathy snort. And Terrence waves his hands.
Whoa.
He steps a few feet outside of our semicircle, paces, crosses his arms, but finds my eyes again once he comes to a standstill.
You're serious.
I am.
Can you prove it?
Jones asks. If it were ready, sure. Yes, I answer, firm.
Really?
Kent watches me carefully. Like everything depends on my next words.
You can prove it.
Yes, I tell him again. But first we come up with a strategy. He nods once.
Then my father will get some. Right?
He asks, about to reach out for an arm shake. He holds back, though, and I can see that his answer is dependent on this. I grip his forearm, just below the elbow, wrapping my hand tightly around it. Your dad will get it, I say, trying to keep the giddy out of my voice. I'm bubbling over twofold. This right here is our first arm shake. Ever. Plus, he's the first domino. Kent's the one that sends the rest of them over. And right before my own two eyes, I watch the balance tip in my favor. Chapter 42. 8 p.m. Sunday.
Why couldn't we just drop it into each roof's rainwater drainage pipes?
Tear offers.
Seems easy enough.
Tear wouldn't make that suggestion. The trump card filters their rainwater before it gets rationed. Most of the sick houses are older buildings, Tear, I tell him, trying not to let on that by older buildings, I really mean poorer. It's the same filtration system as the racks. We do it ourselves, with sand. Put the medicine through the system, and you'll end up with decent drinking water, but not exactly a cure. He goes quiet.
Didn't realize that, he mumbles.
That, and people need to think it's the cure. Or who knows if they'll take it. They might not drink it beforehand, and that's the only way it'll protect against the poison. Nodding, everyone is quiet for a moment.
We could route it like a roof race.
Jones says as he looks down at a map of the ward projected onto the floor.
Except, instead, we'd all start and end on a different building. How many stick houses are there?
He pauses, then realizes something.
Do we even know how many people are sick?
Just around 800, I think, I answer quickly. DI stats come in handy so rarely, and information like that is kept under wraps, especially with a population of only a few thousand. As for sick houses, 20, each with about 50 beds? That I know from my time spent searching for Avon.
Some beds must be empty then, Jones says.
We all go silent. Statute 1, ruthless and irrational as it is, served its function. It reduced the sick population.
So that makes,
Tear does the math in his head,
around 40 patients in each sick house.
Jones nods.
Okay. What if we have your doctor friend,
he says, nodding to me.
Put the cure in packages. We can make rooftop drop-offs at each sick house. Then we just have to divvy those up between the four of us and make up routes according to distance and what our individual mobiles can do.
Kent, Tear, and I all exchange blown-away looks, because I don't think any of us thought Jones had that in him. Just as I'm about to chime in, remind everyone that my Rimbo might still be out of commission, we hear a noise coming from the outside.
It's got to be Benny.
I jump up and run to the window, peeking around the corner. I didn't realize it. The thought of seeing him, it's like new air fills up my lungs, as though it's been years, not hours. He'd probably scowl if I told him this because he's not one for cheese, but with him on my side, there ain't nothing that feels impossible. When I see his white, wiry head of hair bob past, I rush out the archway and half-tackle him. And when he sees me, his eyes go wide, then they narrow. He squints, drops his bag, covers his mouth, and then laughs until he cries, arms open. For someone who doesn't hug, when Benny gets a hold of me, he keeps a pretty tight grip. But then again, so do I.
You're going to be the death of me, Renata, he says into my curls.
I laugh but shake my head. Sure hope not, I answer.
I'd have it no other way.
At that, I can't help it. I'm crying, and it's not from sadness. Benny drapes his arm over me, and we walk down the narrows back to the vault. But just as we're about to step inside, he slows down, stops.
Renata,
he says, and I turn to face him. What is it? I don't like his tone. It's too grave, considering that he just learned I'm alive.
It's about your mobile. I wasn't able to uncover anything, but I returned to the first roof to see if anyone had video footage of the race with their comm. Turns out someone did, and you're not going to like what I saw.
What did you see? I ask, tripping over the words as they leave my tongue. I don't know what I would do with more bad news. I can only handle so much.
The footage showed Derek underneath your Rimbo, right near the Plan B wiring. He's the one who tampered with the mobile, not Kent.
My arms drop. My breathing stops. My own heart knives me in the gut.
He tried to kill me?
It doesn't make sense. Derek kissed me. Something is missing, some piece of information.
Are you sure?
I whisper. Benny nods, but he doesn't avoid my eyes. That's how I know how sure he is. When we walk back into the sanctuary, we're quiet, solemn.
I don't believe it,
but I have to. Benny wouldn't lie. There's something I don't know. I'm praying that I'm right about that, and until I know what that something is, if there's a something at all, I have to keep myself sane, focus on the moment at hand. The other racers tip their chins to him, even Kent, because Benny's a champ, no matter how you slice it, and he gets respect even if he's my mech. We bring him up to speed, and when he hears the part about my being a mole, he says,
Renata, did you honestly expect me not to notice you installing that filter before each race? I knew what you did, and had my suspicions about who it was for, but the search for fresh water has always been an honorable one.
While grumbling to myself, pretty sure I've gone red in the face, I think I see Tear look at me. Reconsider how much he hates me. Maybe. Jones tells him about the plan so far, and Benny nods, agreeing that it's a good one, until we get to the part where I don't have a mobile. Callum even offered to let me take his before I left. I had to tell him what happened to it at that point, though I'd been avoiding it. He took the news pretty well, though he did say telling his mom was going to be the worst part. Then he actually said that he was just glad I was safe. It was pretty big of him. Do you think you can have it ready? I asked Benny. He could do it. With anyone else, that kind of request would be impossible. Benny touches his chin, scratching his whiskers.
I think so.
Then, yes.
Yes, I believe so,
he says, surer. For the next hour, the five of us grapple over maps, divvying up routes.
I call this building, Kent says, pointing his finger over Quad 2, and we all look at one another like he's nuts, when he adds, my dad's sick house.
We understand, and drop our heads, quiet. Still, we can't let Kent take his dad's building. He drives a Honda, souped up, yes, but it's got no speed over the water, and we tell him so. His face flushes, says he wants Jones to do it for him, but that doesn't work either. The two of them drive basically the same mobile.
Terrence, you promise you'll get it to him?
Kent insists when we decide Tare is the only one who can do the job. Since he'll be taking the Cloud, and the Cloud can cross Central Bay, he's getting all the northern quads, including Kent's dad. The mobile's not as fast as ours, but she's good with distance, and sick houses up north are few and far between. Most are in Midtown, in quads 5 and 6.
Yeah, man, Tare says sincere. I got it covered.
If only that were the last thing Kent goes head-to-head on, though. We argue over every detail. Whose mobile is actually faster? How to drop off the packages? Out the floor latch? Or by slowing down and tossing them out the moonroof? If we should all start at once, or stagger the start times? We bang our heads together over each possible outcome. And when that's done, we get to the real hard stuff, calculating headings between roof jumps. But with Benny and Tare here, they're able to breeze through the math, so soon it looks like the worst is over.
Wait, Tare says, and he points to a building in Quad 6. We're forgetting one thing.
I see where he's looking and shake my head. It hasn't been forgotten. Standing in front of the map, I black out that spot with my shadow. Ward Hope is mine. The guys give me the same look they had for Kent.
But it isn't on your route, Benny says, confused,
and he passes his finger in the air over the zigzagging line I've been assigned. I was hoping no one would mention the hospital until after I'd made the delivery, but no such luck. As I glance at Kent, something in my gut warns me to tread lightly. He's not going to like this. And it isn't going to be. The Ward Hope drop-off has to be done first anyway. It's not like we can just dump a package on the hospital roof and expect that it will make it to the patients. Drugs need to be administered. So Callum had the idea to add the serum to their water supply. Kind of like what you suggested at first, Tare, I say, nodding at him. But it has to be added after the water is filtered, and before it's rationed. Callum showed me maps of where it needs to go. Then, during nightly rations and when nurses change IV bags, everyone will get it. Quickly, Kent looks up, soft all of a sudden. I'd like some too. Here it is. This is what my gut was warning me about. Knowing he's not going to like why I've got to say no makes my blood pump a little faster. Everything is so fragile. We can't do this without him. First off, I say evenly, it isn't made yet. Callum's working on that as we speak. Second, it isn't going to be dosed per person. Callum knows exactly how many people there are in the HBNC wing, and he's making one whole batch that he'll give to me. The cure will get dosed properly in the rationing pipes. If you take out even a tablespoon, that'll be one less drop for everyone else, and then the meds may not work. I look at Terrence, hoping for some backup, but he can't help with this. Kent jerks back, then strides up to me, gets in my face. This is Brack, and you know it. The muscles in his neck ripple out, clenched tight. It's not, I stammer, and look around, but no one has a life raft to throw me. I'm sorry. The tension in the vault puts everyone quiet. Jones and Tear stand ready to leave, but I don't think anyone wants to end on that note. And no one wants to go up against Kent either. So I'm on my own. I wish I could tell him different. We'd made progress, armshake and all. Why is it that everything I decide ripples out in ways I'd never imagined? Even the good choices, if those exist, have a way of hurting someone. Sorrier than he'd believe, I watch him pass through the archway made of femurs. His whole body's hardened like a boulder. For a moment, I worry that he won't help us anymore. Quickly, so he can hear, I say to the others, Callum will show you guys how the cure works once you guys get there. I'll comm you the address. I tap my wrist before everyone steps out into the night. The city is quieter than before. The revelry's died some, but not that much. It seems everyone's got their windows open tonight, hollering between apartments or sitting in fire escapes. It's a night unlike any other. I follow the guys out onto the narrows, expecting Tear to be waiting for me so maybe we could talk. But he hasn't. I'm alone. I'm not alone. Waiting, back up against a building, is Kent. He's holding in his rage. I can see that clearly. Whether or not he lets it loose all depends on my answer. And I still can't tell him what he wants to hear. One more time, I'll ask you, he growls. I look at him and step away. Didn't know his black eyes could get any blacker, but that's what they do. The look he gives me could cause earthquakes, put a 9.0 on the Richter. I can't, I stammer, my back pressed against brick. Kent throws his fist into the building. I jump to the side. He's an animal, roaring away his anger. But under it, I can hear something else. He's sad. Plain and simple. He kicks the narrows, storms away.